The following podcast contains explicit language.
It's Friday, April 15th, 2016. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. So there are some things that every man, every person should do. Well, some things that every man should do. Some age-old things that they always tell you. Here are the skills you need to survive. Things like build a fire and gut a pig, dress a deer. I don't even know what that means. I don't think it's like a weirdo taxidermy thing. I mean, I think it means take off the skin. Okay, so we've moved past that and the things a man should do. Now, things a person should do to get along in modern life. Maybe you can do them, maybe you can't. A lot of them with cars, right? Change a tire, change your oil. But I think in the modern age, the biggest skill a person can have is knowing exactly how much gas to refill the car that you rented with 3/4 of a tank that's now on a little less than half. You have to look at the gauge in the car. You have to use your internal gauge. And I got to tell you, I'm really good at this. But I was recently challenged because I didn't rent just a car. I rented a van. I rented a 15-passenger van, a 15-person van. In my case, 13 of the 15 people in the van were 8 or 9 years old. Actually, my youngest son was and is 7. So I drove a van of 7, 8, and 9-year-olds to Long Island from New York City, where the kids were to be bouncing off the walls, or at least into the walls. It was a trampoline birthday party. Sure, no problem. I was just a little, wasn't where I knew I could do it. Wasn't that much wider than an SUV, just a little bit longer. Tried not to get into any parallel parking situations, but actually I did, and I pulled it off. The van was fine. I think libertarians will talk about helmet laws, and when you ride a bike with a helmet, you are less safe. I don't know if I believe that. And maybe if I rode or drove this van for years, I'd be taking risks, but I was really safe with the van. There was one thing I was worried about: how to gauge the fuel gauge, because I rented it with 5/8 of a tank, and I was worried about how much gas to put in, because I didn't want to spend an extra $11. So as I was driving out to Long Island, I took a glance or two at the fuel gauge, and things were going well. In fact, it wasn't dipping below, let's say, 5/8 of a tank. And then, after I was driving back from Long Island, I looked at it, and the fuel gauge was actually at more than 3/4 of a tank. This is crazy. Either the fuel gauge is off, or it actually seems to be gaining fuel, or what I think happened was sometimes, you know how when you first turn it on, it doesn't go up all the way, and maybe it's a big tank because this is a passenger van, and the guy quickly wrote down 5/8 of a tank, but he didn't let it get to all the way at a little bit over 3/4, because I'm looking at it, it's a little bit over 3/4, and I'm great. I'm in Clover. Drop the kids off, take the van to the place where I return it, and there it is. The thing is to the right of the 3/4 dash mark. And I'm saying to myself, I almost can't believe my good fortune. So I, in fact, take a picture of it, and the picture shows how many miles I had. So I'm not fooling that I took it at some earlier time. It's the exact mileage of when I dropped it off to the 10th of a mile. So they know that I'm not lying about this. And there's the fuel gauge sitting to the right of the 3/4 mark. So, as I'm telling this story, like I said, this is what a guy should do. This is an accomplishment. I got away with not having to refill this van. Who knows how expensive that would be? And as I'm bragging about this, and I show the picture to a friend, I notice something. The E is on the right side of the fuel gauge, and the F is on the left. I wasn't gaining fuel. I was losing fuel. It was inching towards empty on a left-to-right basis. Well, I got in touch with the people at the car rental place. It's not a national brand. It's a local off-brand. And they're so nice. And they laughed with me. And they charged me $20. But that wasn't the premium that you'd have to give if you didn't refuel it yourself. So I guess this serves a lesson that what every person needs to know how to do is to either gauge how much fuel to put in your van, or to so misread the fuel gauge as to make the person at the van rental place laugh. On the show today, I spiel about the Democratic debate that just happened. And by just, I actually record this from my apartment. Hope that makes it fresh. And I'm going to try something new in the credits. I'm going to give you consumer tips related to car rentals. But first, in 1986, Bernie Sanders was the mayor of Burlington, Vermont. He ran for governor, did not do that well. got in the low single digits. In 1986, Hillary Clinton was first lady of the state of Arkansas. So what all this means is that neither one of them had time to craft or sing a number one hit. Who did? Chris Malamphy is here, counting down the number ones. People ask me, why do I have Chris Malamphy on so much? And I say, for good times, for bad times, he'll be on my side forevermore. Because after all, that's what friends are for.
And I never thought I'd feel this way. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad I got the chance to say that I do.
Which is just one of the number one songs of the year, 1986. A year of not so much eclectic number ones, but memorable. Wait a minute, or was it just that I was 14 years old? The exact sweet spot for when you're listening to pop music. Chris Malamphy writes the Why Is This Song Number One column for Slate. We take a year, we talk about the number ones. Hello, Chris.
If we're doing That's What Friends Are For, do I get to be Elton John or Stevie Wonder?
Those are friends. It was billed to Dion and friends.
Right. I'm okay being one of those friends if I get to be one of those friends.
Those weren't her psychic phone friends. Now.
No, yes. They were not psychic friends. They were just friends. It's a song that was waiting for its moment. It had actually been knocking around the music business for a few years. This will make you chuckle. It was actually originally recorded by Rod Stewart in 1982 for the movie Night Shift.
Oh.
Henry Winkler.
Sure. And Shelley Long.
Shelley Long and
Keaton. Michael Keaton.
Very good. Yes, that's right. Dionne Warwick picked it up for a record that she was recording for her friend Elizabeth Taylor for AMFAR. This is very early in the days of understanding about AIDS generally, never mind a charity for AIDS. It spent 4 weeks at number one and wound up being the number one record of the year starting in January of 1986.
Can't lose. You can't lose when you're going down a list of hits and you get How Will I Know by Whitney Houston. What a song.
This is the moment when, you know, Whitney is kind of taking over. Her album, Whitney Houston, self-titled, was the number one album of 1986. It wound up spawning 4 top 10 hits, additional R&B hits, basically began to shift the sound of pop music toward what I call the melismatic diva, the power singer that, you know, would come fully into vogue in the 1990s after Mariah Carey broke about 4 years later.
Greatest Love of All also was a number one hit for her this year.
Show them all the beauty they possess inside. Give them a sense of pride to make it easier. Let the children's laughter remind us how we used to be. Everybody searching.
Debate, you know, it's one of those things. The George Benson original was great. Perhaps you could argue that the Whitney Houston cover was unnecessary, and yet just in terms of its quality, and we're glad that it's out there, sure, fine. The big question is, why did they drop the word "the" from the title? George Benson, it was called The Greatest Love of All. Whitney Houston's song was called Greatest Love of All, and I wondered if that was for any, like, complex legal reason.
I'm glad you asked me that, Mike.
Yes.
Because do you know why George Benson originally recorded the song in 1977, what the occasion was?
No.
It was recorded for a Muhammad Ali biopic.
Ooh.
Called The Greatest.
Ah.
And so the in the George Benson original from 1977, it was probably intentional. It was probably meant to allude to the greatest, namely Muhammad Ali.
Because the greatest love of all was happening to me. I found the rain.
unlovable inside of me.
If most of these songs were on the radio, they could mostly be played on the same radio station, sort of a light rock station, songs like Invisible Touch and Glory of Love and Higher Love by Steve Winwood. But there are exceptions. And a weird song, which lasted on in the number one slot for 3 weeks, as opposed to a lot of these great memorable songs, which lasted fewer than that, was Rock Me Amadeus by Falco.
Yes.
Who is Falco?
Falco is a man of Austrian descent who had already scored hits across Europe in the early 80s. Most famously, he scored the biggest hit version in Europe of the song Der Kommissar. And then he comes out of nowhere with this ode to Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, in which, let's not put too fine a point on it, Falco is rapping.
Superman is a superstar. Yes.
And I don't know about your memories of being 14 years old, Mike, but I vividly recall that, not unlike Nena's 99 Luftballons a couple of years earlier, it was a song that many radio stations in America actually preferred the German lyric version of, even though the chorus was always Rock Me Amadeus. Yeah. It was always in, you know, German-accented English. The verses were much better in German than they were in English.
So there are a number of really good songs on this list, or songs that have stood the test of time. Say You, Say Me.
Say You, Say Me.
Hearts, These Dreams gets played in a lot of places. Of course, everything Madonna ever touched, like Live to Tell, that was a number one song of that year. Papa Don't Preach was the number one Madonna song of that year. But for my money, the one song that if you were to make something equivalent of the American song canon, a song that it shows up in commercials but is covered and really allows a singer to show their emotions is Cyndi Lauper with True Colors. This is not the most famous Cyndi Lauper song, I guess. Girls just want to have fun. But True Colors is one of those songs just from the writing quality of it that's, you know, could be Judy Garland. It's transcendent.
It's not actually a Cyndi composition. Cyndi is herself a songwriter. Her number one hit from 1984, Time After Time, was a song she wrote. This song was written by a pair of journeyman songwriters, Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly, who've written a number of other number one hits. It's a big year, 1986, for what I call gun for hire songwriters. I actually did a count. By gun for hire, I'm defining these as professional songwriters, almost in the Brill Building mode of the 50s and 60s. These are people whose job it is to write number one hits. Neither in the mode we now think of it in the Rihanna era, where you throw, you know, eight people in a room and somebody does the top line and somebody does the melody line, nor in the Brill Building mode of, you know, Jerry Goffin and Carole King, but closer to that mode. It's a very professional moment for songwriting. So you have everything from True Colors by Billy Steinberg and Tom Kelly to, you know, the Burt Bacharach, Carol Bayer-Sager song we mentioned earlier. They were actually two by Burt Bacharach this year because they also co-wrote On My Own, the Patti LaBelle, Michael McDonald number one hit. It's a big year for song doctors or song smiths with, you know, long professional resumes.
This was, I think, Bon Jovi's first number one songs. The Slippery When Wet album had two number ones, and the first was You Give Love a Bad Name.
You Give Love a Bad Name, I have argued in my writing, is both a detestable record, in my opinion, but also a very important record, because it's the moment when hair metal converts itself from music for adenoidal teenage boys to music for pretty much everyone, including women. It was a song that was all about the sing-along chorus. It was all about the pop hook. After Bon Jovi, The Deluge, suddenly everybody's scoring top 10 number one hits. Bon Jovi kind of signals the breakthrough of the hair metal sound. It's
thanks, Jovi.
Yeah, pretty much.
Après Jovi, Le Deluge.
Indeed.
Detestable why, lyrically?
I have always called Bon Jovi captain of the football team music.
It's, oh, that's pretty good. That's
it's kind of music for the winners in high school. It's personally, and I wrote a whole article about this, so this is personal for me. I see 1986 as a pivot year. It's the year when new wave and British accented pop was ushered out in favor.
But Pet Shop Boys was there.
That's right. This is literally the pivot year. You've got number one hits by the Pet Shop Boys. You've got a number one hit by Peter Gabriel.
Human League.
You've got a number one hit by the Human League, although they are adapting because they're working with Jimmy Jam and Terry Lewis. You've got basically two strains of late 80s pop that are making their emergence in 1986. I would call one of them big-haired diva pop in the form of what Whitney Houston is doing, and I would call the other one big-haired metal in the form of what John Bon Jovi is doing. And you're now seeing the template being written for the second half of the 80s. So the stuff that we all enjoyed in the first half of the 80s, certainly I enjoyed, and I'm showing my bias here, you know, your Human Leagues, your Pet Shop Boys, your Tears for Fears, your Simple Minds, that stuff is going to become old hat after 1986. And the LA Sunset Strip metal sound and the big voice diva sound that would later take shape in the form of people like Taylor Dane and eventually Mariah Carey, that's what's coming in the final years of the 1980s.
Yeah, for the male artists, it's guitar supplanting synthesizer.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Chris Malamphy writes the Why Is This Song Number One column for Slate. We take a year, we talk about the number one hits, and 1986 had a lot of them, and they were mostly memorable. Thank you for rocking us, Amadeus. Thank you, Chris.
You got it, Mike. Sometimes you're better off dead. There's a gun in your hand that's pointing at your head. You think you're mad, too unstable, kicking in chairs and knocking down tables in a restaurant in a West End town. Call the police, there's a madman around, running down underground to a dive bar in a West End town. In a West End town, a dead end world, the East End boys and West End girls.
And now the spiel. Brooklyn in the house, or at least the Navy Yard. The New York Post on Monday ran a story about a teenage girl, 15-year-old, who was suspended from high school for smoking in the bathroom. Actually, it was vaping in the bathroom. That was the news item. Now, the girl voiced Dora the Explorer, the Nickelodeon cartoon, so I guess she was a celebrity. But basically, there was the girl, there was her name, and there was the fact that she was suspended from a high school for vaping. This was the Post's judgment on Monday. On Friday, the Post's judgment was Donald Trump for president. But the funny thing about this is, even the New York Post, even that paragon of judgment, could not come to fully endorse Trump. They noted, we think he'll pivot. We think he'll mature. We think he'll change his tone. And oh, by the way, a lot of his ideas, like troops out of Japan and South Korea, actually terrible ideas. Well, some other candidates were found lacking by a New York institution yesterday.
It happens to be true.
Oh, it is true, because that institution was New Yorkers themselves, the hootin' hollerin' masses, the assembled armada of attitude at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, but not everyone exhibiting poor judgment.
And let's talk about judgment.
Not everyone exhibiting poor judgment was a member of the crowd. Some of the people saying the stupidest things were mic'd and on stage, and I don't mean the candidates.
She's not even sure you are a Democrat, are you?
Yes, he's a Democrat, Wolf.
Given your obvious contempt for large American corporations, how would you, as President of the United States, be able to effectively promote American businesses around the world?
And of course, the answer is, well, I don't think I'd call it a contempt for business. Bernie was at his best when he was answering questions. You notice, I've noticed, that Bernie does this. If you ask him a question, he'll actually answer the question. He might then use it to go and talk about what he wants, but he'll always answer the question, right? Like, you'd have to ask Trump that, or I think contempt's a dumb word. Here is one of Bernie's best answers to a question. And in fact, the third moderator, Errol Lewis of the New York Daily News, he was a good moderator.
Earlier this week at the Apollo Theater in Harlem, you called out President Clinton for defending Secretary Clinton's use of the term super predator back in the 90s when she supported the crime bill. Why did you call him out?
Because it was a racist term and everybody knew it was a racist term.
So if Bernie was pointed, he's a little vague on details. And if Hillary Clinton sometimes engages in circumlocution, she also knows a heck of a lot of facts. If there was a through line to this debate in trying to determine who, quote unquote, won it, I would say the point usually went to whichever candidate was articulating a position more in line with the will of Democratic voters. Not always the more liberal position. I don't think Bernie got the better of Hillary on the exchange about Israel just because Bernie expressed a more pro-Palestinian sentiment. In fact, I think, especially in New York, liberal voters more or less support Hillary's position. I think, by and large, both candidates expressed their position well. And when Hillary won a point, say, on guns, it wasn't because Bernie got sandbagged or because Hillary lied or exaggerated. It was because Bernie's stance is less in line with what a typical Democrat would want his stance to be. Now, that said, Bernie does have the more exciting position, not necessarily the more bumper sticker ready position. You could make a bumper sticker about the word prudent and wisdom and $15 trillion sock to the economy. But when stating a position like Bernie stated about single payer, that's going to get a cheer. And it's harder to get a cheer when you're stating the opposite, which is that's not wise. That's not where we should be spending our political capital. It was really, really hard to get done what we got done. Let's not try to go for everything and therefore lose what we already have. Notice how you weren't whooping as I said that, but notice how you also might have been agreeing with me. Every once in a while, the candidates did stumble, go too far, say something ridiculous, like Hillary on her talking about healthcare.
We've got to do much more to finish the work of getting universal health care coverage, something that I've worked on for 25 years. Before there was something called Obamacare, there was something called Hillary Care, and we're now at 90% of coverage. I'm going to get us to 100%.
No, there was the phrase Hillary Care. There never was Hillary Care. It never became a law like Obamacare did. Still, her overall basic point is it was really tough to get Obamacare to be a law is a good one. Bernie overstated his case at times. He accurately wanted to brag about the string of successes he had, but he went too far when he said,
Secretary Clinton cleaned our clock in the Deep South. No question about it. We got murdered there. That is the most conservative part of this great country. That's the fact.
Right. So his wins in Utah, Wyoming, Idaho, and Alaska, those were in places that are purple, places that are up for grabs. In general, when they talked about policies, sometimes I agreed, sometimes I disagreed, but in both cases, neither should complain that they weren't allowed to give full voice to their positions. When they got into the politics, especially the hypothetical politics, polls say that I would do better in a head-to-head matchup. Well, let's see if you get there. And that is the great thing about this debate. It wasn't that high-minded. The questions weren't that good. The audience was ill-behaved. Bernie has passion, and he works that passion. Hillary has authority, and she relies on that authority. He has the high ground on some issues, like not taking speaking fees from big banks or big corporations. And she got the better of him on other issues, like being allowed to sue gun manufacturers. Plus, I'll say this for Hillary. She does get to keep the almost $1 million she got for speaking just to Verizon and Goldman Sachs, plus all those other fees. The greatest thing about this debate wasn't that it was high-minded, wasn't that the questions were good, wasn't that the audience was well-behaved, wasn't that we got much that was new. It's that in 4 days, there will be an actual vote. To quote the Brooklyn crowd, woo, yay, you the man! And that's it for today's show. Just producer Andrea Salenzi has this tip. When you rent a car and don't know which side the gas tank is on, there's a little arrow on the gas icon that'll tell you which side to fuel up on. Steve Lickteig, executive producer of Slate Podcast, wants you to know not to buy insurance from the rental card company. Most credit cards provide no charge insurance. And there's a site called Insure My Rental Car, which will insure you for $8 a day. There's another site called Protect Your Bubble. It used to be Protect Your Bubby, but grandmother insurance is just not that thriving a market. Andy Bowers is chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and he's here with this tip about additional drivers. First of all, California, they can't charge you for one. But you know when you go to rent a car, it's like, oh, what's the difference between Alamo and Avis and Dollar? They all have totally different policy towards additional drivers. Avis, Budget, Enterprise, no additional driver fee for a spouse or domestic partner. Thrifty and Dollar, they charge a fee for additional drivers. Hertz, National, join their club, and there's no fee for additional drivers. The Gist, apparently it's your tip-off to a rip-off. Oom-peru-de-peru-do-peru, and thanks for listening.